on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 93-year-old Robert Farwell. Before we're done, we're going to talk about one of the prestigious medals he earned. We've heard about what he did in World War II and how he survived 8 months as a prisoner of war. When we left off, he was back in the Air Force, as it had become by then. He had a civil engineering degree from USC, and right after you graduated in 1950, while war was brewing in Korea, you found yourself in another part of the world. Where did they send you, and what were you doing?
I got orders to go to Wheelis Field, Libya, which is in North Africa. At that time, Wheelis had been a World War II base. It had been inactive from the time the war ended until now in the summer of 50. They decided to open it again, and I ended up going there as the base civil engineer.
So what did they have you do? What was your task that you had to finish?
Well, the task was to maintain what was there, but actually there was very little going. There was one power station that had a couple of old diesel engines in it. There was very little housing. All of the housing that existed at the time were the old World War II stuff that was built by the Italians. The runways were a mess. No barracks, no housing, not much of anything, so the task was to start the repairs and start the rebuilding at Wheelis Field, which we did.
So I don't want to exaggerate. I don't want to give you too much credit or too little here, but it sounds like you oversaw the complete renovation of that base.
Yes. After a short time, I was there patching the runways and started to build some barracks. The Army decided to bring in the Corps of Engineers because we're facing a major rehaul and rebuilding program. So the Corps came in and established their headquarters there, and then they took over the major construction program, resurfacing the airfields, extending the runways, building barracks, rehabbed a hospital. But as the base engineer, I worked with them on planning and everything else, and then in the meantime, my responsibility was to maintain everything else, and then I was responsible for accepting the finished work from the Corps. And so I gave the final inspection and signed off the papers for the Air Force.
So this is all more than 60 years ago. The U.S. operated that base until 1970, when it was turned over to the Libyan government after Muammar Gaddafi had overthrown King Idris. The U.S. actually bombed that airbase in 1986 when Ronald Reagan sent in that group of F-111s against Gaddafi. And yes, that airfield that Mr. Farwell renovated, it is still there in Tripoli. In fact, it figured fairly prominently in Libya's civil war in 2011. So a lot of history has unfolded on that ground you were moving in the early 1950s. But what about just the experience of being there in that part of the world for that time? Was that eye-opening for you?
Well, yes, it was. Libya at the time was basically the poorest country in the world. There was very, very limited agricultural land right near the ocean, and the rest of the place was just desert. At that time, in the late 40s, early 50s, I think the population of Libya was a million, maybe a million and a half Arabs, and a few Italians, and that was about it.
Your globetrotting was just beginning, because the military had a few other destinations for you. Where did you go from there?
Well, from Libya, I went back to the States at Westover.
After Libya and after the Korean War, America was not technically at war, but we look back on that period now as the early days of the Cold War. And you had a role that was quite related to the Cold War that sent you all over the world. What were you doing with a program called MATS, and what does that stand for?
MATS is the acronym for Military Air Transport Service. And I was in Washington then. As I said, my responsibility was building the overseas air bases. Keflavik, the Azores, North Africa, Doran, and Saudi Arabia. We rebuilt Hawaii, the base at Hickam, and then Johnson Island. We were responsible for the development in Japan in that area, but somebody else took that part of the Far East Pacific over. I didn't have anything to do with that.
So you mentioned Iceland, the Azores, North Africa, Hawaii, where Hickam Field was. These are some interesting destinations, and you had to go to each one of these sites and design things for them?
Well, we designed it out of the States when I was at Andrews. Of course, we used architect engineers, private firms to do the engineering and the architecture, but I was responsible for directing that enterprise. It was a very, very interesting program, and it got a lot done.
And why was it so important to have all these bases in those locations in the grand scheme of things with world geopolitics of the day?
Well, at this time, what was going on was known as the Cold War, and it was really a race with the Russians to be certain that we could withstand any attack that they put on. So we were very busy expanding our radar networks, our early warning networks, like I say, in Iceland and Newfoundland and northern Canada. That stuff was designed by us out of Mats. I would periodically take visits to all these places. I spent a lot of time in Iceland.
I'm curious, too, because of your background and what you'd been through previously. Here you'd been shot down by the Germans, prisoner of war, subject to Hitler's forces. And I think it's easy for people now to look back on that and say, boy, what a tumultuous time in world history. But I'm curious how the feeling you had during the Cold War and all these duties that you had, did you feel as much gravity, as much importance, maybe as much concern for the future of the world during the Cold War as you did as a POW?
You know, it was a real fight going on there at that time. We perhaps overrated the Russian mentons. But at that time, they were bent on world domination. They were about to take over most of Europe. Frankly, it was our determination and for us, stationing troops in France and Germany and Italy to make sure that the Russians didn't take over the whole thing.
When you think about all those years you spent doing that kind of work, going over plans for this base and that base, and many of those bases are still there, some of them still in use today. What are you most proud of with that work that you did?
Well, probably at that time period, the most important project that I had that we completed was a communications program. From the States, we built what we call tropospheric scatter stations from the States into northern, into Canada, to Greenland, to Iceland, to Scotland, and then all over Europe, so that by the time that was finished, anybody at any Army, Navy, or Air Force base in the States could pick up a phone and dial anybody in any station in Europe or North Africa, Turkey. That was a tremendous program and very, very successful.
I'm sure most of the people listening have no idea what this is. I mean, we live in the day and age now of cell phones triangulated from a satellite up there in the heavens somewhere. You didn't have this in the 50s and 60s. Who thought up this idea and how did it work?
Well, it was necessary to get the communications going. And that's the biggest reason for doing this. At that time, as I say, we had a radio network that worked, but it was one of those things where there was a lot of static, and when you talk to somebody and you got finished saying, you said over, and then he could pick up the conversation to come back, but there was no just going back and forth like we can today. And by the time this program finished, that was over with. We got phone service, you know, throughout the world. That's just similar to what we do today.
In fact, this reached all the way into Vietnam during that war, and you received the prestigious Legion of Merit Medal for your work on this. But can you explain to us, in layman's terms, the technology of how this worked? Because I think some of our brainiac tech people out there will say, what in the world are these guys talking about? You would actually bounce radio waves off part of the atmosphere? Is that right?
Yeah, what we call tropospheric scatter. Take huge, a lot of power, and antennas that pointed at the sky in the direction you wanted to go, and the signal would bounce off the stratosphere, ionosphere, whatever you wanted to call it, and then be picked up at a farther station, for example. And from the U.S., we would go to northern Canada, from Canada to Greenland to Iceland there. And then once you were in Europe, it was a microwave all over the place, except that from England, we did tropospheric center to Spain, and then from Spain to North Africa and to Italy. Once we were in North Africa and Italy, we could cover the rest of it with microwave.
So the impact of this program was to greatly expedite communication, so you could get a message somewhere a lot faster than you used to be able to?
Yeah, when it was over with, you could pick up the phone any place and have a normal conversation like we can today.
And at the time, this technology wasn't available to anyone else. This was just the U.S. military that was capable of that?
I think so. I don't think anybody else could do that.
And what was your specific role in the implementation of that?
Well, my role was to build the facilities that housed the equipment, provide power, housing, and everything else for the crews that would stay there to operate this communication system. It meant building barracks and the buildings that house the transmitters and receivers and the antennas and so on. We designed and basically the Corps of Engineers built all of this stuff all over.
And one of your stops was the capital city of another country that has produced quite a few headlines recently. What were you doing in Iran?
We were in Tehran because we were providing to the Iranians radar stations for early warning. We were furnished the equipment and the money, and they were building. And I went to Tehran and probably there for maybe 10 days. And we traveled from Tehran to a couple of different locations in the western part of the country where they were building these early warning radar stations.
So this was all because of the threat of Russian missiles?
This was the Cold War. We were bound and determined we were going to be everywhere in the world. And that the Russians couldn't get there in front of us. So that was a pretty tense period.
Well, and I want to ask you about some of the other work you did in the Cold War, but I'm struck just listening to you and hearing you mention some of these locations. And they're places that have been in the news a lot in the last couple of years. And both with your work in the military and with the Bechtel Corporation after you got out of the Air Force, you were in places like Saudi Arabia, very near to where the Gulf War took place, the part that you were in. You're in Tehran, where obviously that's been in the news nonstop in recent years, and in Libya, where the chaos has certainly been widespread. What's your perspective? How surreal is it for you to see all these news stories, the video that comes out of these places, and think back to the time you spent in all of them?
There are parts of this world that have almost always been chaotic. The whole Middle East, you know, even today with our support of Israel and Egypt, the whole place is a powder keg. It's an evolving story, and it's a dangerous place.
Did it seem that way then, or was it just that grander tension of the U.S. against the USSR and which country was going to choose which team, so to speak?
There was a contest between the Russians and us, have friends or dominate, if you want to put it that way, the different countries and the different cultures. In our part, primarily defensive, and we think, or thought at the time, on the Russians' part, as an antagonistic expansionist period. I'm not sure if the Russians agree to that, but that's what it seemed to us at the time.
And there was that threat of mutually assured destruction because of the nuclear capabilities of both of those superpowers. And when it came to what America did to prepare for or even prevent thermonuclear war, Mr. Farwell again played an interesting role. We're going to get to that when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.